Tell me about your big meeting the other night, Tool said. You just rest. Don't talk no more. He placed the pie tin on the bedstand and grabbed the TV remote. He clicked through the channels until he found a nature show about white pelicans, which he thought might interest Maureen. He remembered her saying that she had been keen on bird watching until she'd taken ill. He recalled her telling about the day that she'd spotted a red cockaded woodpecker, which was sort of like a red-headed woodpecker, except hardly any of them were left on the whole entire planet. So Tool figured he couldn't go wrong with any TV program that had to do with birds. Sure enough, Maureen right away lifted her head and scooted higher on the pillow. She said,
Did you hear that, Earl? They migrate all the way from Canada to Florida Bay, the white pelicans do.
Well, I'll be damned, said Tool. Maureen began coughing, a wet hack that he found alarming. He lifted her upright and whumped her between the shoulder blades, which only made her moan. Gently, he set her back on the pillow. A nurse who'd heard Maureen making noises came into the room and demanded to know what Tool was doing.
It's all right. He's my nephew, Maureen said, slowly catching her breath.
The nurse was a small Hispanic woman who was struggling to reconcile Tool's uncommon physical appearance with his white medical coat.
He's a doctor, Maureen added.
Oh, really? Said the nurse.
From the Netherlands.
When the nurse was gone, Maureen said,
Normally, I don't like to fib, but I believe she would have called security.
Tool asked, Where's your kin? How come they don't never visit?
My daughters live in Coral Gables. It's a long drive, and they've got the kids to worry about. I see them on holidays.
Ain't that far, Tool said. It's a hop on the interstate is all. They could come weekends at least.
Did you need more medicine?
With some effort, Maureen rolled herself toward the wall. Her gown was open in the back, and her skin looked dull and waxy. Tool observed that all the fentanyl patches had been removed. She said,
Take what you need.
They's all gone.
Oh?
She rolled back and faced him.
I'm sorry, Earl. They must have peeled them off when they put me on the morphine.
Her eyes flicked to the IV bag.
They gave me a squeeze pump so I don't have to bother the nurses, who, by the way, are just sitting on their flabby duffs doing nothing, complaining about their no-good husbands and reading the National Enquirer.
Tool said,
I don't need no more stickums. I just come to say hi.
The truth was he'd missed her company. It was the damnedest thing.
I think there's one left in that drawer, Maureen said. Go on and take it.
The patch was still in its wrapper.
What the hell, thought Tool.
He slipped it in his breast pocket.
Earl?
Yeah?
Something's bothering you. What is it?
I'm fine, Tool said.
You are not fine, young man. Talk to me.
Tool stood up.
Go on back to sleep.
He decided not to tell her about Perrone shooting that woman and all the rest. Maureen wouldn't understand, and besides, he didn't want to upset her. Once more, she reached for his hand.
It's never too late for choosing a new direction, what they call a sea change. Promise me you'll keep that in mind.
He said,
You're gonna be okay. Them doctors, they'll get you some stronger dope. I'll see to it.
Maureen closed her eyes.
Listen to me, Earl. It's yourself you ought to be thinking about. Life goes by so darn fast. Every wasted moment is a crime.
One blue eye opened and fixed on him.
And every crime is a wasted moment.
Tool assured her that he'd stay out of trouble.
This job will be done soon. Then I can get on home.
but I've got such a bad feeling, she said.
Stop it now. Don't you worry.
He found it jarring to feel sad for this woman, who was practically a stranger. She in no way reminded him of his mother, who had been loud and short-tempered, a world-class blasphemer. Yet as Toole watched Maureen tugging the sheets up to her chin, he felt the same creeping helplessness, the same heavy premonition of loss as when his mother had taken sick.
"You go see the surgeon yet?" Maureen asked.
"No, ma'am. I've been real busy."
With skeletal fingers she pinched a clump of his knuckle hair and twisted it until he let out a cry.
"Earl, you can't walk around with a lead slug up your bottom. It's bound to affect your outlook."
Toole jerked his hand away.
"I'll get it took care of, I swear."
"It could well be the turning point in your life," she said. "What they call an epiphany, or at least a catharsis."
He assumed those to be the surgical terms for a bullet removal, and he promised Maureen he would schedule the operation as soon as he got a break in his bodyguarding schedule.
"I'll be back later in the week," he promised.
She looked up at him warmly.
"Do you pray, Earl?"
"Not in a while," he admitted. 30 years at least.
"That's all right."
"Well, I better go now."
"Every time my faith is shaken, I look up into the big blue sky and see God's work practically everywhere. Just imagine a bird that flies all the way from Manitoba to Key West every single winter."
Toole found himself turning toward the TV screen. A large flock of snowy pelicans was taking flight, rising in a flurry from the rippled surface of a marsh. With a little imagination, it looked like a long, sugar-white beach breaking to pieces and blowing away in the wind.
"I'd like to see that someday," Toole said.
Soon Maureen's hand slipped from his, and Toole knew from the heaviness of her breathing that she'd fallen asleep. He watched the bird program until it was over, then switched off the television. As he was leaving the convalescent center, the Hispanic nurse got in step beside him and asked if he was really Maureen's nephew.
"I don't see much resemblance," the nurse remarked.
"That's 'cause I'm adopted," Toole said.
"Really?
And back in the Netherlands you're a physician?"
"No, a doctor," he said pointedly.
"Ah."
"Sneaky little bitch,"
Toole thought, squeezing himself into the Grand Marquis.
"Thought she could trick me."
15 miles away in the Loxahatchee National Wildlife Refuge, a man with one eye was skinning a dead otter. The man was tall, and his hands were large, and his skin was as brown as an English saddle. He wore dungarees, military boots, an opaque shower cap, and a threadbare T-shirt with a lewd, lapping tongue silkscreened on the front. His beard was a spray of braided silvery tendrils, the tips of which were green and mossy with dried duckweed. The man looked ancient and mildly demented, although he moved with the fluid confidence of an athlete or a soldier, both of which he once was. The otter had been killed a few hours earlier by a poacher who hadn't realized until too late that he himself was being stalked. The man with one eye had easily disarmed the outlaw, stripped off his clothes, bound his wrists and ankles with sawgrass, then staked him on a hemp leash to an alligator nest. Rika Spillman had witnessed it all. She was floating in a state of suspended awareness. Even after 2 days, she wasn't certain if the one-eyed man was real. If he was, however, he had saved her life. The man informed Rika that they would eat the dead otter because that was better than leaving it to the buzzards. When she inquired about the fate of the poacher, the one-eyed man said,
"If the gator doesn't get him, I suppose I'll cut him loose. All depends on his manners."
"What about me?"
The man made no response, the blade flashing in his hand as he deftly peeled the flesh of the otter away from the damp, thick fur. When he was done, he said,
"Tell me again about your boyfriend."
Rika repeated the story of Chaz Perone while the man prepared a small fire. The otter meat smelled funky, but Rika was so famished that she forced it down. The man devoured everything else in the fry pan, crunching noisily into the marrow of the animal's bones. Afterward, he kicked dirt over the flames, wiped his palms on the seat of his dungarees, and lifted Rika into his arms. "How's the leg?" he asked, and began trudging through the scrub.
"Much better today. Where are we going, Captain?"
That was how the man in the shower cap had asked to be addressed. "There's another camp not far." He carried Rika as lightly as if she were pillow fluff. She said,
"How soon can I go home?"
"You have a pleasing voice. It makes me want to sleep in your arms."
"Will you take me home, please?"
"Sorry," the man replied, "but I can't go near the highway. Please don't ask. The traffic sets me off."
The next camp was a small clearing in a stand of palmettos. He set Rika on the ground, lit another fire, and heated a pot of coffee. From a canvas duffel marked U.S. Postal Service, he took out a volume of poetry. "Oliver Goldsmith," he said. Rika raised her eyebrows quizzically. The man opened the book to a dog-eared page and placed it on her lap.
"Read that aloud, please."
"The whole thing?"
"Just the first stanza."
Rika, whose interest in poetry had piqued with Green Eggs and Ham, read it first to herself.
"When lovely woman stoops to folly, and finds too late that men betray, what charm can soothe her melancholy? What art can wash her guilt away?"
When she recited it out loud, the man in the shower cap smiled patiently.
"You don't much care for the poem, I can tell," he said.
"What guilt is he talking about? I don't feel guilty. I feel pissed off."
"Understandable. The son of a bitch shot you."
"And he lied, too, about everything."
The man took the volume of poetry from her hands and returned it to the duffel. Rika said,
"I'm dying to get even with the bastard. Will you help me?"
The man popped the glass eye from its socket and cleaned it with the dingy tail of his T-shirt. He had heard gunshots from half a mile away, slogged through the sawgrass and muck and high water, half walking, half swimming. By the time he'd gotten there, the shooter was already gone, a pair of red taillights shrinking down the levee. Rika had desperately submerged herself in a clump of lily pads. The man with one eye had located her by following the intermittent gasps that she made when extending her lips and nose to the surface. Shaking and bleeding from a wound in the leg, she had nonetheless tried to fight him off, reasonably assuming from his appearance that he was some kind of dangerous swamp pervert.
"I'm sorry, but I can't help you. I'm going through a rough personal spell," he told her now.
"What do you mean?"
"For starters, I'm hearing the same weird duet all day and all night in my head. Midnight Rambler, as performed by Edie Gourmet and Cat Stevens. I'm sure they're perfectly nice folks, but frankly I'm ready to shove a sod off down my throat. One blessed hour of silence," the man said wistfully, "would be welcome." Rika said nothing. The sight of his hollow eye socket, dank as a cave, was creeping her out. "On top of that, I'm hallucinating almost constantly," he went on. "I'm assuming, for example, that in reality, you bear no resemblance to Lady Bird Johnson."
"Who?"
Rika asked.
"The wife of our 36th president.
He was the fellow who sent me to Vietnam," the man explained.
"To me, you look exactly like Mrs. Johnson, which I know must sound preposterous. You're a much younger woman, with cinnamon freckles and curly hair. Yet when I look at you, all I see is Ladybird."
"Know what you need? A doctor."
The one-eyed man grinned, and it struck Rika that he must have been extraordinarily handsome before he went bonkers. Even now she felt an unnerving stir of attraction. He said,
"It's entirely possible that I'm dying."
No way, Captain.
There were times in my life when I would have jumped at the opportunity, he allowed, to hunt down your shiftless boyfriend and haul him out here for a private party. I'm not talking mundane revenge either, but a textbook exercise in predation. Please understand, there's a primordial formula for survival on this planet, and men like your Chad...
Chaz,
Rika said, tend to perform poorly without dry socks, dental floss, and air conditioning. Even that wretched low-life poacher whom I hog-tied this morning is better equipped for this world than... Chaz, is it? The man clawed at his ears. That god-awful singing! It will not stop!
I can't hear a thing.
Last week it was David Lee Roth and Sophie Tucker. The panfish in these canals must be loaded with mercury. He leaned over and stared hard for several moments into the flames. You say your bow works out here in the glades?
That's right. He tests farm water for pollution.
Too bad we've never crossed paths, he and I. The man chuckled to himself as he worked the glass orb back into its socket. I can carry you as far as the dike. From there a friend of mine will drive you into town.
Then what?
Rika asked. Me, I'm heading west. He handed her a cup of coffee. The other day I got so damn hungry I ate a pygmy rattler. Normally I leave reptiles alone, but a mighty powerful urge took hold. Anyhow, I go to grab the little sucker, and suddenly there's the face of Dr. Henry Kissinger staring up at me, flicking that little forked tongue of his. Fucking Kissinger! Rika Spillman had never heard of him either, but she politely asked,
So what did you do?
I chopped off his head, of course, the man said, and fried his scaly ass in canola oil. Point is, I'm navigating a rocky patch in my private life. I positively can't be anywhere near the highway or crowds or humanity in general. I wish to God I could help you, but I'm taking a pass. Rika said,
That's okay. I'll figure something out.
She wondered if the rattlesnake story was intended as some sort of mystical lesson. As if reading her mind, the man said, Go with your gut, darling. Simple as that.
I'll work on it.
After dousing the fire, the burly hermit scooped her up and splashed out across the marsh. It was an hour's hike under a blistering sun, yet he wasn't even breathing hard when they reached the levee. A mud-splattered jeep was parked on the road. Waiting behind the wheel sat a younger man wearing a knit watch cap and dark shades. He looked restless and intense. The captain kissed Rika on the forehead and told her to be careful on that bum leg. She returned the kiss and said,
Thanks for saving my butt.
The man with one eye saluted dashingly. It was an honor, Mrs. Johnson. 24. Dr. Charles Regis Perrone bounced behind the steering wheel of his Hummer, weaving down the levee at a ludicrous speed. Every so often he poked his head out to scan the sky, which was full of helicopters. It was the weirdest spectacle, choppers buzzing over the Everglades like giant, candy-colored dragonflies. Chaz felt like the Ray Liotta character in Goodfellas, racing around like a lunatic with a load of hot guns, wondering if the helicopter following him was real or imaginary. Except that instead of that Harry Nilsson song from the movie, Papa Thorogood was blasting in Charles Perrone's ears, asking who did he love. It was ideal road music. But Chaz couldn't get into the spirit. He was heading out to collect another water sample, and he was highly agitated. Maybe there was an innocent explanation for the helicopters. Baby blue, green, red, white, baby blue again. Maybe a hunter or fisherman had gotten lost, Chaz speculated. Except these weren't rescue-type choppers he was seeing. They were private executive-style models similar to the nifty little Bell 206 leased by Hammernut Farms to ferry Samuel Johnson Hammernut back and forth across his holdings. Red had given him the grand tour soon after Chaz signed on as his mole. Chaz's first and only helicopter ride, swooping low over the checkerboard fields of crops. From the air, Chaz had been able to track the precise path of the pollution. the gridwork of shallow brown canals that carry the tainted runoff from the soil of Hammernut Farms to the throat of the Everglades.
God's septic tank, Red had called it,
guffawing behind tinted goggles that had made him look like a psychedelic fruit fly. Dr. Charles Perrone had laughed, too, an obsequious reflex, though hardly insincere. Chaz gave not a damn about the wetlands below, or what a continual soaking with fertilizer might do to them.
Shit, Chaz thought. Here comes another one.
He kept his eyes on the red-striped helicopter for so long that he nearly drove the Hummer off the levee. The jostling awakened Tool, who mumbled,
"Slow down, dick brain."
Urgently, Chaz jabbed a finger upward.
"Check it out."
"A whirlybird. So what?"
"There's a whole bunch of them."
Tool sneezed, then wiped a woolly arm across his nose.
"Maybe they're shooting a movie."
As Chaz scanned the horizon, his head twitched back and forth. It reminded Tool of a lizard scouting for bugs.
Tool said, "You crash this fucker into the water, I'll strangle your ass before you can drown."
"But what if they're following us?" Chaz asked.
"What if fish had tits?"
"I'm serious. Jesus, see that blue one right behind us? Look in the mirror."
Tool, who was feeling the effects of a fresh fentanyl patch, slammed his eyes shut.
"Whirlybirds, I swear to God," he said,
and promptly nodded back to sleep. Chaz parked at the spillway, struggled into his wading gear, grabbed the two-iron, and slogged into the brothy water. He counted 7 helicopters in the sky, each circling at different heights. That they were surveilling him seemed chillingly obvious, so Chaz was careful to conduct the runoff sampling with diligence and deliberation. He tried his hardest to appear unconcerned, although he peed copiously into his waders when the baby blue chopper dipped low and slowed to a hover directly above his head. By the time Tool awoke again, Chaz was racing back halfway down the levee. The helicopters were gone.
"Give me the cell," Chaz said.
"What for?"
"I need to call Red."
Tool tossed the phone to Chaz, who was sweaty and flush with anger. Chaz speed-dialed the office in LaBelle and demanded to speak to Mr. Hammernut.
"He's where? Fishing? That's terrific," Chaz snapped at Red's secretary.
Tool smiled drowsily. Fishing sounded like a pretty sweet way to spend the day. Chaz was fuming.
"Then put me through to his voicemail."
"Call him later," Tool advised.
"No, no, this can't wait. Red? Red, this is Chaz. Listen to me real good. We get out to the second spillway this morning and the whole damn sky is full of helicopters. I'm not sure who they are or where they came from or what the fuck's going on, but since you're the only one I know that can afford to hire a goddamn fleet of choppers, what I'm trying to tell you, Red, is be careful. Very, very careful. You don't want anything bad happening to me. You truly don't. You want me to stay happy and calm and cool, which is dead opposite of the way I feel right now. Shit! The machine cut me off."
Chaz was so upset that he was panting. Tool grabbed the phone and said,
"Boy, you done lost your marbles."
"That's what you want me to think, isn't it? That's a secret plan, right?" Chaz poked his head out of the Hummer and looked up anxiously. The sky was bright and clear and empty, except for a solitary vulture rafting high in the thermal. Joey Perrone had remembered that Goodfellas was one of her husband's favorite movies. That's what gave her the idea for helicopters. Corbett was thrilled and said it would be spectacular. He called the charter service himself and put the whole tab, more than $23,000, on his platinum card. Joey didn't like to fly because of what had happened to her parents, but Corbett promised that she'd have a fine time. "Choppers are a blast," he said. And he was right. The baby blue Bell Ranger picked them up on the island and shot out low across the bay, then up the coast. Corbett took the seat next to the pilot. Joey sat beside Mick Stranahan, both hands latched to his left arm. He pointed out Stiltsville, where he'd once lived, then Key Biscayne, South Beach, the high-rise canyons along Collins Avenue. The helicopter banked and began to pass over dense suburbs, gridded by impossibly congested roads. Joey could see that the interstate was locked down in both directions because of an accident. At the vortex of the traffic jam was a twinkling of red and blue emergency lights. Corbett swiveled in his seat and raised his voice to be heard over the rotors. "No offense, sis, but I'd stick darning needles in my brain before I'd live in a place like this." Later, as the pilot angled northward, Joey heard her brother gag in revulsion at the sight of western Broward County, where new subdivisions were erupting like cankers in all directions. Thousands upon thousands of cookie-cutter houses jammed together so tightly that it looked like you could jump from roof to roof for miles on end. Where there were no homes stood office parks, shopping plazas, and enormous auto malls, acres and acres of Toyotas and Chryslers cooking in the sun. Only a slender dirt levee separated the clamorous tide of humanity from the Everglades. "At least they left a lake or two for the kids," Joey remarked. Mick shook his head sadly. "Rock pits," he informed her, "hundreds of feet deep. That's where they dredged up the fill for the roads and houses."
"But what used to be out here before all this?"
He pointed toward the other side of the levee. "That," he said, "the widest river in the world." Corbett let out a sarcastic whoop.
"I just saw a tree," he cried. "I swear to God, a real tree."
Before long, the sprawl gave way to wet sawgrass prairies that undulated like flooded wheat in the brisk spring breeze. Except for an occasional airboat, gnat-sized specks on the tan landscape, there was no evidence of human occupation. Stranahan spotted three small deer bounding for the shelter of a tree island, and it occurred to Joey that, except for the occasional garbage-looting raccoon, these were the first truly wild animals that she'd seen since moving to Florida. She'd always been curious about the Everglades, but Chaz had refused to take her along on field trips, claiming it would violate the Water District's rules. That he never spoke of the place except to gripe about the snakes and the insects was even more stunning to Joey now that she'd finally seen it for herself. How could Chaz, a biologist, for God's sake, not be dazzled? Obviously, however, he wasn't. He had betrayed the wetlands as nonchalantly as he had betrayed Joey. He had sold out, this greedy swine she'd married, so that megatons of noxious crap could be pumped day and night into the glistening waters below. Maybe for someone as soulless as her husband it wasn't much of a reach, Joey thought, from killing a place to killing a person. "Look out there," Stranahan said. The other choppers had arrived, six in all, flying clockwise in concentric circles. It was quite a show. Joey turned to Corbett and said, "You've outdone yourself. This is fantastic." Chaz Perone's yellow Hummer was hard to miss, even without the plume of dust trailing it down the levee. Stranahan handed Joey a pair of binoculars, through which she could see her husband's windblown head protruding from the driver's window and cocked toward the sky. "He does not look overjoyed," she reported, drawing a gleeful cackle from her brother. Their pilot was on the radio, double-checking the flight paths and altitudes of the other helicopters. A Cessna from the Palm Beach Sheriff's Office broke in, a Sergeant Robinson inquiring about all the chopper activity. The pilot of the Baby Blue Bell replied that they were rehearsing an aerial chase for the new James Bond movie, a glamorous lie that produced the desired effect. The police Cessna banked sharply and drifted away. Authorities in South Florida were famously accommodating to the film industry and had been known to shut down major freeways so that a teenaged vampire drag racing scene could be shot and reshot without artistic compromise. When Chaz finally parked the Hummer and waded into the water, Joey insisted on buzzing him. It was Corbett, however, who persuaded the pilot to put the aircraft into a hover directly above his brother-in-law's hatless noggin. The helicopter stayed high enough that Chaz couldn't have seen who was aboard, but he didn't even try. It was amusing to watch him fumble with the water bottle while pretending not to notice the shadow of the chopper or its ear-splitting racket.
That's enough, Joey called out, and the pilot pulled away. They circled at a greater distance, alternating low sweeps with the other helicopters, until Chaz finished the sample and sped off in the Humvee. What do you suppose he's thinking? Corbett asked. Unhappy thoughts, Joey said. Nick Stranahan laughed. Wait until he sees the newspaper. Later, after returning to the island, they all went fishing in the whaler. Stranahan caught several nice yellowtails, which he fried Cuban style for dinner. Afterward, Corbett lit a cigar, and Joey modeled the silk Michael Kors skirt that she'd purchased at the Galleria. Mick uncorked a bottle of Australian Cabernet. The three of them sat together on the seawall and watched the sun go down, Strom parking his black brick of a head on Joey's lap. "What should I say about you on Thursday?" Corbett asked. He was drafting his speech for the memorial service. "You can say I was a kind and loving sister," Joey said.
"Aw, oh, come on. We can do better than that,"
Stranahan said. "Say she was a tiger. She never quit fighting." Corbett beamed. "I like that. Say she was full of life and had a big heart." "No, a dumb heart," Joey said. "Not true," Mick touching her arm. "I'll say you were idealistic," Corbett said. Joey frowned, which is just another word for naive. "Then say she had great legs," Stranahan said. "Well, why not?" Corbett chortled. Joey covered her ears. "Stop it, both of you!" Corbett hadn't been able to line up a choir on short notice, so he'd settled for a trio of guitarists. "They do the folk mass at the Catholic Church in Lighthouse Point. The priest tells me they're pretty good," Joey said. "What if Chaz doesn't show up?" Corbett tipped his red blonde chin and blew a wreath of smoke. "Oh, he'll be there. He knows how bad it would look if he didn't." Stranahan agreed. "Right now he's scared to death of making a wrong move. He's got no choice but to play the grieving widower to the bitter end." "God, I wish I could be there," Joey said. Stranahan shot her a look. "Don't even think about it. You promised."
"But I could make myself up so that he'd never know it was me."
Her brother said, "Joey, this isn't the Lucy show. The man tried to murder you." She was silent for a while, sipping her wine and stroking Strom's sleek neck. The sun dropped over the horizon, and the sky over Biscayne Bay turned from gold to pink to purple. Joey wondered what her husband would wear to the service, where he would sit, what he might say to her friends, whether he would notice Rose in the first pew. Of course he would notice Rose. "Now, that was a first-class sunset," Corbett said, flicking his cigar into the water. The hiss roused the Doberman. Corbett whistled, and the dog clambered to its feet. Stranahan got up, too. "Let's go take another look at the video." Corbett remarked that it had turned out surprisingly well for having been shot in a single take. "You two have a future in television."
"Hey, I just thought of something," Joey rose, smoothing her skirt. "What if Chaz wants to say something at the memorial service? What if the jerk decides he's got to get up and make a speech?"
"Damn right he's making a speech," Corbett said. "I already left a message on his answering machine. Told him he's getting 5 minutes in the pulpit to make you sound like the saint you were. Told him it better be good." Captain Gallo pointed at the jelly jars on Carl Rolvog's desk and said, "Those are the worst-looking urine specimens I ever saw." Rolvog faked a chuckle out of deference to rank. "It's just water. After passing through what? A diseased buffalo? Water from the Everglades." The detective had meant to conceal the jars inside his desk in order to avoid precisely this conversation. Normally Gallo took a much longer lunch hour, but evidently his bimbo du jour had stood him up. He peered disgustingly at the hazy contents of the jars. "Christ! There's bugs and crap floating around in there." "You betcha," Rolvog said.
can I ask what the hell it's doing out here? Unlike most of the other detectives, Rolvag never felt comfortable lying to Captain Gallo's face, even when it was the eminently sensible thing to do. This time he gave it a try. It's for my snakes. There are too many chemicals in the water coming out of the tap, Rolvag said. All that fluoride and chlorine, it's not healthy for them.
And that shit is?
Gallo asked incredulously.
You're a head case, Carl, no offense. Who else do you know has pets that need swamp water and live rats?
The detective shrugged. Telling Gallo the truth wouldn't have accomplished anything. He would have scoffed at Rolvag's field trip as a waste of time, which it most definitely was not. Using Marta's map, Rolvag had located by automobile a sampling site adjacent to Hammernut Farms. There he had waded barefoot into the cattails and filled 3 mason jars with water the color of root beer, which he'd delivered to a professor friend at Florida Atlantic University. Rolvag's amateur samples had revealed illegal levels of suspended phosphorus at 317, 327, and 344 parts per billion, respectively. The figures contrasted dramatically with Dr. Charles Perrone's suspiciously consistent findings of only 9 ppb in the runoff from the vegetable fields. Rolvag did not share his own test results, or his damning conclusions, with Perrone's co-workers at the Water District. While politely deflecting their questions, he'd gotten the distinct impression that none of them would be heartbroken to see Chaz dragged off in handcuffs. The detective had offered no details about his investigation, for it was possible that the scientist's fraudulent water charts were unrelated to the death of his wife. If Joey Perrone's last will and testament was authentic, Chaz might have killed her purely for the money. If the will was a forgery and Joey's inheritance was not an incentive, Chaz might have killed her for any one of a dozen pedestrian reasons that drove spouses to homicide. Explaining the phosphorus scam would have brought either a blank stare or a skeptical snort from Captain Gallo, who would have instantly pointed out the difficulty of selling such an arcane motive to a homicide jury. Nonetheless, the fact that Charles Perrone was faking the Everglades data was a valuable piece of information for Carl Rolvag. It put the strange blackmail scheme into a more ominous context, considering what was at stake for Samuel Johnson Hammernut. Disclosure of his illicit arrangement with the biologist would be devastating, financially and politically. The pollution violations would draw hefty government fines, and bribing a state employee was a felony, punishable by a hitch in prison. Even if Red Hammernut managed to escape conviction, the publicity alone would forever stain the reputation of his company. Rolvag believed that the crusty tycoon would do whatever was necessary to protect himself from the blackmailer, and also from Chaz Perrone, whose loyalty would evaporate as soon as the cell door slammed behind him. When Gallo asked how the case was going, Rolvag said, "Not so great. I'm getting mixed opinions on Mrs. Perrone's will. Her brother says it's a fake. Unfortunately, so does one of my 2 handwriting experts."
"Does that mean somebody's trying to set up hubby for a fall?"
"Possibly. Chaz hasn't got many admirers." Rolvag sneezed convulsively. It was one of those days when the captain had put on his cologne with a fire hose.
"Too bad about the will," Gallo said. "I thought we had our lucky break."
"Me too.
So, you're finally ready to bag it?"
Gallo asked hopefully. "Unless something breaks loose, I don't know what else to do," Rolvag said. In truth, he knew exactly what to do. Sit back and watch. "No sense banging my head against the wall," he added.
"You gave it a hell of a shot," Gallo said.
"Oh, well.
By the way, Carl, I got your paperwork on the resignation. I tore it up and threw it in the trash,"
Rolvag said. "That's all right. I made copies."
"Would you knock it off already?"
"I'm quitting, Captain. Seriously."
"For Edina, Minnesota? Leaving Florida?"
"Honestly, I can't wait." Another dog a toy poodle had gone missing at Sawgrass Grove. Rolvag had never heard of binge feeding by pythons, but he couldn't discount the possibility. Something seemed to be preying on his neighbor's pets, and his missing snakes were prime suspects. The detective planned to mail an anonymous check for $1,000 to each of the grieving couples, an act that would clear not only his conscience, but also his bank account. "You've got a bright future here," Gallo said. Rolvag tried not to appear amused. "The man himself has taken notice of your good work," Gallo added in a confidential tone, the man being the sheriff. "I thought he was ticked off about me interviewing Hammernut," Rolvag said.
"Hell no, Carl. He was just covering his ass, is all. He's a big fan. Trust me."
The detective did not for a moment suppose that the sheriff was a fan, and he could barely summon the energy to act flattered. Gallo said,
"For Christ's sake, what have I got to do to change your mind? And don't say indict Charles Perrone."
Rolvag smiled. "Don't worry." The detective had accepted the fact that Perrone would never be charged with murdering his wife, even though he had most certainly pushed her off the cruise ship. What had saved Rolvag from abject discouragement were the jars of cloudy liquid on his desk, swamp water salted with the harshest man-made fertilizers. That Chaz Perrone would betray a place as hallowed as the Everglades for money was proof of his congenital dishonesty, rancid morals, and general worthlessness. Yet while the discovery of the biologist's sleazy crime had confirmed Rolvag's suspicions about the so-called scientist, it was more ironic than revelatory, because Charles Regis Perrone was doomed. The detective had never been more sure of anything. After sifting every wisp of information that he'd gathered, Rolvag realized that he needn't waste another minute trying to send Chaz Perrone to death row. The man was already a goner. Toast. He was arrogant and impulsive, and Samuel Johnson Hammernut was going to make him disappear. Even had Rolvag wished to intercede, he would only be delaying the inevitable. Chaz Perrone was, as his brother-in-law had observed, a hopeless fuckwit. If for a moment he feared that his fakery of the pollution data would be exposed, Perrone would immediately roll over and rat on Red Hammernut, meanwhile casting himself in the least felonious light. And who would foresee this scenario sooner or more clearly than the man who'd recruited the young biologist precisely for his cravenness and casual mendacity? Red Hammernut could smell a buttfuck coming a mile away, and he'd never stand still for it. Carl Rolvag could now leave South Florida with a measure of peace, if not satisfaction. Chaz Perrone would never be prosecuted for killing his wife, but he would be punished. All that remained to nag at the detective was a solitary loose end, something that had turned up on a routine inquiry to American Express. In the 12 days since Joey Perrone went overboard, somebody had used her credit card to rent a Chevrolet Suburban and also to purchase women's shoes, makeup, designer sunglasses, and numerous articles of fine clothing, including a 2-piece Burberry swimsuit. Rolvag didn't believe that Chaz Perrone was reckless enough or tasteful enough to embark on such a shopping spree, though it was possible that one of his female acquaintances had found and pocketed Joey's gold Amex while visiting Chaz's house.
"I can't believe you're actually boxing up all your shit," Gallo was complaining, his knuckles planted on Rolvag's desk. "I can't fucking believe you're going through with this."
The detective smiled apologetically. "I miss the snow," he said. One more visit to West Boca Dunes, Phase 2. Then he could start loading the U-Haul. 25. Charles Perrone said, "I'm not going anywhere."
"Red says different.
Tool leaned against the refrigerator, gnawing a stick of beef jerky and sucking at a jumbo Mountain Dew.
I don't care what Red says.
Rolled in Chaz's right hand was the Sun Sentinel, which he brandished like a lead pipe. A notice on the obituary page said that Joey's brother was holding a memorial service at St. Conan's on Thursday morning, and that Joey's friends and loved ones were invited to come share their memories and celebrate her effervescent life spirit.
Spare me, Chaz thought.
A photograph, taken when Joey was about 18, accompanied the announcement.
Now the phone was ringing off the wall, and that New Zealand nutcase, Corbett, had left a pushy message telling Chaz to write up a 5-minute speech.
You better damn well care what Red says, Tool warned.
Oh, yeah?
The deterioration of Chaz's mental state had failed to shake his hope that the last will and testament in Detective Rolvog's possession was authentic, and that ultimately he'd be inheriting $13 million from Joey's estate, at which point he could say adios to Samuel Johnson Hammernut, and thereafter never set foot in that godforsaken sump known as the Everglades.
He says it'll look real bad, Tool went on. You don't show up at your own wife's service.
I don't care how it looks. I won't go.
Chaz's nerves were still jangled from the helicopter blitz, which in his memory loop now seemed less like the chase scene from Goodfellas and more like the flying monkey scene from The Wizard of Oz. Meanwhile, Red Hammernut had offered no response to Chaz's accusatory phone call from the levee, and the uneasy silence only added to a cascade of anxieties. What a psychological pounding Chaz had endured since that night on the Sun Duchess. The creepy break-ins at the house, the lurking detective, the witness-turned-smart-ass blackmailer, the Rika crisis, and now mysterious spy choppers. Chaz's current game plan was not to leave the walled confines of West Boca Dunes Phase 2 until the rest of the fucking world stopped picking on him.
I won't go to the service, he repeated with ill-advised defiance.
Tool capped the jug of Mountain Dew, calmly stepped up to Chaz, and decked him with it. When he tried to get up, Tool bonked him again. The second blow busted a seam in the plastic bottle, unleashing a stinging green fizz that sprayed Chaz flush in the face. Tool jerked him off the floor and said,
Somebody's ringing the doorbell. Get rid of them.
Chaz thrashed his head violently, collapsed to his knees, and scuttled like a wounded crab beneath the kitchen table. Tool sighed.
Swear to God, I wished I had your sorry ass in one of my tomato crews.
He trudged to the front door and flung it open. The cop was standing there holding a briefcase. Tool nodded him inside. Is Mr. Perrone here? Carl Rolvog asked.
In the kitchen.
Tool spun on a booted heel and headed to his bedroom for a snooze. The detective found Chaz rocking in a fetal position beneath the table. Bad day? He asked.
Stomach problems.
Chaz was relieved that his reflex to lie was unimpaired. Rolvog joined him on the floor.
I've got a couple of questions that can't wait.
What else is new?
Chaz pawed miserably at his burning eyelids.
Your wife had an American Express card. So do the friggin' Muppets.
Where is Joey's? The detective asked.
Like I told you before, I got rid of all her stuff. Everything, Chaz said. It was too painful having it around the house. The credit card was probably in one of her purses that I threw away.
Which purse? The one she had on the cruise?
How should I know? I tossed them all.
Any chance that her card and her driver's license were stolen? Rolvog asked. Chaz uncurled slowly and rose to a sitting position. He thought about the break-ins. Wouldn't it be just his luck if the blackmailer had rifled through the boxes in the garage and found Joey's Amex? Reason I ask, the card has been used several times since your wife disappeared. The detective said. Not by me. Mostly for ladies' apparel, makeup, that sort of thing. Chaz was honestly baffled. He hoped that it showed. Would any of your wife's friends do something like that? Or any of your friends? Rolvag asked. Chaz knew what the detective meant. Girls Chaz might be boffing on the side. He said,
How would they get hold of her card? I'd have to be a complete idiot.
Rolvag's expression indicated that the possibility had occurred to him. It had to be the blackmailer, Chaz thought, or maybe Rika. Who else had been inside his house and could have swiped Joey's American Express card?
Hey, what about Mr. O'Toole?
Chaz blurted eagerly. The detective smiled. I can't see him in a Burberry bikini, but you never know.
Well, maybe he's got a girlfriend, Chaz said, thinking, and maybe someday cows will play lacrosse. Hey, you know what? I bet Joey's credit card got stolen on the cruise ship, he said excitedly. Those cabin attendants, they all had master keys to the staterooms.
Rolvag conceded it was possible. In any case, you might want to notify American Express and cancel your wife's account.
Oh, absolutely, Chaz said,
although he'd never get around to doing it. In idle moments, he would find himself daydreaming about the many slender, dark-skinned beauties who worked aboard the Sun Duchess, and wondering which of them was now lounging on the beach in Aruba, sunning herself in a new Burberry two-piece. When Rolvag returned to the office, Captain Gallo intercepted him at the door. Mrs. Perrone's brother is here. He looks like he's auditioning for an Outback commercial. Corbett Wheeler stood in the waiting area, chatting earnestly with a spindly, gap-toothed woman whose crack-addled offspring had just been caught stealing the airbags out of a marked police cruiser. Wheeler wore a wide-brimmed hat and a long, cowboy-style coat, and he carried a wooden staff that looked sturdy enough to pound fence posts. When Rolvag walked up and introduced himself, Wheeler thrust a large brown envelope at him. My sister's will, he said. The real will. Let's go back to my desk. You want some coffee? Joey's brother idly leafed through a book of mugshots while Rolvag studied the old will. It divided Joey's fortune among several charities and conservation groups, the largest share going to the World Wildlife Mission. The detective took out the document that had been sent to him and carefully compared the two signatures. Although they were not identical, they weren't so dissimilar as to rule out the newer one as a forgery. Corbett Wheeler held up the mugshot album and asked, "Who are these people?" His expression was that of an anthropologist who had stumbled upon evidence of a lost tribe. "Known burglars," Rolvag replied.
That's amazing. These are only the known ones?
Just the ones who work the beaches. We've got four more volumes that cover the rest of the county. Corbett Wheeler closed the album.
That lady I was talking to earlier, is her son's picture in here?
If it's not, it will be.
Lord, how do you do this every day without going mad?
Actually, I'm moving back to Minnesota.
Good for you. And they've got no crime up there?
Sure, but it's seasonal, Rolvag said. Breaking and entering is hard work when it's 20 below. The crowbar tends to freeze to your fingers. He laid the two wills side by side on the desktop so that Joey's brother could examine the signatures. I'm no expert, Corbett Wheeler said, but yours looks like a trace job. A pretty good one if it is. Well, Chaz Perrone has had plenty of opportunity to practice. Corbett Wheeler was well aware that the fake will had been drawn up by Mick Stranahan's shyster brother-in-law, then signed by Stranahan with deliberate, though subtle, imperfections. Corbett had a role to play, as Stranahan did. Joey wouldn't leave a penny to Chaz. Take my word for it. I wish I could, the detective said.
Meaning you haven't got enough to arrest him.
Correct. Corbett Wheeler shrugged. Too bad.
But you know something? I'm a firm believer that what goes around comes around.
Rolvag thought of Chaz's dicey status with Red Hammernut, but he said nothing. Would you mind if I came to the service?
Noon tomorrow, be my guest.
Corbett Wheeler leaned closer. The bereaved widower will be delivering a eulogy. I can hardly wait. Joey's brother stood up and shook Rolvag's hand solidly.
Thanks for trying.
It's been a tough case, unfortunately.
What happened on that cruise ship was no accident, believe me. That low-life yuppie turd-hopper shoved my little sister overboard.
Rolvag said, That's what I think, too. Proving it is the pisser. He accompanied Corbett Wheeler to the waiting area, which had been taken over by a troop of visiting Boy Scouts. Rolvag himself had been a scout when he was a teenager, back in the Twin Cities. His most enduring memory was of the day he'd nearly sliced off his thumb while whittling a miniature totem pole.
They do any sheep farming in Minnesota? Corbett Wheeler asked.
Yes, I believe they do.
You should give it a try, Carl, if you ever burn out on police work. The lamb is a universal symbol of innocence, you know.
With that, Joey Perrone's brother raised his burl walking stick, pushed open the door, and walked out. After sleeping with Mick Stranahan, Joey concluded that her physical relationship with Chaz Perrone had not been as exceptional as she'd thought. While Mick wasn't as robotically durable as her husband, he was far more attentive, tender, and enterprising. For Joey, it was something of a revelation. With Mick, there was no furtive peeking at his own clenched buttocks in the mirror, no collegial exhorting of his manhood, no self-congratulatory rodeo yells when he was finished. In Chaz's embrace, Joey had often felt like a pornographic accessory, one of those rubber mail-order vaginas. With Mick, she was an actual participant, a lover. The orgasms had been quake-like with Chaz, but then he would immediately demand to hear all about them. He was always more interested in the reviews than in the intimacies. With Mick, the climax was no less intense, but the aftermath was sweeter, because he never broke the mood by asking her to grade his performance. It wasn't only because he was older and less egocentric than Chaz Perrone. No, Mick had manners. He knew how to stay in the moment. Joey lay her head on his chest. It sure was nice of Corbett to leave us alone for the afternoon.
A gentleman and a scholar, Stranahan murmured sleepily.
Corbett Wheeler had taken the Boston Whaler up to Virginia Key. From there, a car service was supposed to ferry him to Fort Lauderdale for a meeting with Detective Rolvag. Joey had offered Corbett the keys to the Suburban, which was parked in Coconut Grove, but he'd said no thanks. He feared that he might maim or murder somebody in a traffic altercation. As soon as the skiff had slipped out of sight, Joey and Mick jumped into bed and camped there. They remained comfortably entwined even when a squall blew across the bay, banging the warped wooden shutters of the house and whipping rain through the window screens.
"I could live out here forever," she said later, when the sun peeked out.
"Not that I'm inviting myself," Stranahan said. "Consider yourself invited, but think about it first."
"You don't want me?"
"More than anything I do. There's just not much to do around here. Some people find they need more than a sea breeze and a Kodak sunset."
"Some women, you mean," Joey said.
"Hell, I don't even have a dish for the TV."
"Then that's it, buddy. We're through." Stranahan tugged her close and kissed the bridge of her nose. He said, "Think about it first, please."
"Geezer."
"Hey, I meant to tell you. That was a brave thing you did, getting back on that ship the other day."
Joey told him not to change the subject.
"But I admit you look damn sexy in the blue blazer."
"An historic moment," he said, "never to be repeated."
"Well, I appreciate the sacrifice."
You looked pretty hot yourself in that silky little number.
Dirty old man, Joey said.
Boarding the Sun Duchess again had been nerve-wracking and eerie. The deck was lower than the one from which Chaz had tossed her, but the view staring down was the same, terrifying. Joey was still amazed that she'd survived her plunge to the sea. She had never been a religious person, but ever since that night the concept of a beneficent and all-seeing God seemed not so implausible. Sometimes I can still feel Chaz's hands around my ankles.
I wish I could make you forget, Stranahan said.
They were so cold, like he held them in a bucket of ice, she said. Mick, is this brilliant plan of ours really going to work? Because I'm not so sure anymore.
It's not too late to pull the plug. From what I saw of Chaz in the canoe, he's pretty much off the rails already.
Gently, Stranahan rolled Joey over onto her back. He propped himself on one elbow and looked down at her.
We could go see that detective tomorrow morning.
Take our chances in court.
She shook her head.
I can't risk it. Chaz is way too slick.
He could have fooled me.
Get a couple of women on the jury and watch out, she said. He's got a way of working on the fairer sex. I'm living proof. Barely living proof.
Stranahan said, okay, then we go ahead like we planned.
Right. But Joey was queasy with doubt. What would her husband do when she surprised him? Try to bullshit his way out of it? Run away? Break down and blubber like a baby? Keel over from cardiac arrest? Attack her?
Chaz's reaction was impossible to predict, but Joey knew exactly what she intended to say. The questions had been gnawing at her since that long night at sea.
She had come to believe that rage was what had kept her afloat all those hours, kept her clinging to the bale of pot, furious at Chaz, furious at herself for marrying such a beast.
"Did I tell you about the poem?" she asked Stranahan. "It was the night he proposed. We were doing dinner at my apartment. He brought me a love poem that he swore he'd written himself. And me, the classic airhead blonde, I believed him."
Stranahan said, "Let me guess where he stole it. Shelley? Keats?
Get serious, Mick.
Shakespeare would be so obvious."
"Try Neil Diamond," Joey said.
Stranahan froze in mock horror.
"Oh, Chaz was clever," she said. "He knew I was too young to be a fan."
Laughing, Stranahan fell back on the pillow. "Which song? No, let me guess. I Am, I Said. That's pure Chaz."
"No, believe it or not, this one was called Deep Inside of You," Joey reported ruefully.
"Let me be the man who blah blah whatever."
"God help me, I thought it was sort of sweet at the time." He wrote out the lines on the back of a wine label that he'd saved from our very first date. "Unbelievable." She turned on her side and Mick tucked against her. "A few months later, I was talking to the bookkeeper at my parents' casino," she said. "A great old broad, as they say. She wanted to know all about my new husband, so I told her how romantic he was, how he'd written poetry for the night we got engaged. And Inez, that was her name, says to me, 'Doll, baby, I'd love to hear it.' So I took the wine label out of the drawer where I kept all the mushy stuff Chaz gave me, and I read the verses aloud over the phone. And naturally, Inez busts out laughing, just like you, and proceeds to give me the scoop on fabulous Neil, whom she'd seen no less than a dozen times in concert. Needless to say, she knew every damn song by heart."
"So, what did Chaz say when you busted him?" Stranahan asked.
"I didn't."
"Oh, Joey,
I couldn't," she said. "The deed was done. We were already married. So I convinced myself that it showed how much he loved me, going to all the trouble of plagiarizing from some old pop star. I told myself he probably went through 100 songs before he found just the right one. Hey, it's the thought that counts. Just because he ripped off the lyrics doesn't mean he's not sincere.
And that's how I rationalized keeping quiet. Stranahan said, you were afraid he'd make up a new lie if you braced him about it. Joey nodded dismally. Exactly. I didn't want to give him the chance. I wanted to keep on believing it was a fluke. And here you are.
Yeah, here I am.
Stranahan lightly kissed the back of her neck. For what it's worth, I can't write poetry either.
Mick, why won't you let me go to the memorial?
Because you're the dearly departed. You're supposed to be dead.
But I can wear a disguise, she said. Come on. I want to hear Chaz's eulogy.
I'll take along a tape recorder. Maybe this time he'll steal something off Sergeant Pepper. Joey wriggled out of Mick's embrace and relocated to the edge of the bed.
That phony, lying bastard, she muttered. He'll have everybody in tears.
Not me, said Stranahan, reaching out for her again. 26. Stranahan drove to Boca in the old Cordoba, which he'd ransomed from the impound lot for $300. He parked at a Winn-Dixie a few blocks from the church so that no one would see him arriving with Joey's brother. Stranahan had planned to wear the muskrat brown hairpiece that Joey had bought for him at the Galleria, but he changed his mind. He wanted Chaz Perrone to recognize him right away from the canoe trip. He wanted to rattle the son of a bitch. The Catholic folk guitar trio was called the Act of Contritionists. They were playing Michael Row the Boat Ashore when Stranahan walked into St. Conan's. He feared it was only a matter of time before they tackled Kumbaya. The church was three-quarters filled with Joey's friends and neighbors, mostly women. Many had attended Joey's wedding, and some might even have sensed she was marrying an incorrigible louse. They wouldn't have said a word to her about it, of course, and she wouldn't have listened if they had. Rose looked resplendently wanton in the front pew. She wore a tight-knit top over a short black skirt, black fishnet hose, and stiletto pumps. Her blinding dye job appeared freshly retouched, an onyx choker accented her long pale neck, and her lips were the color of fire coral. By comparison, the other members of Joey's book group looked like spinster ants. Near the rear of the church sat a medium-built, fair-skinned man in a dark gray suit that was shiny from wear. He had cop written all over him. Stranahan assumed it was Carl Rolvag, and he chose a seat a dozen rows up on the other side of the aisle. Kumbaya came and went in rounds. Still no sign of Chaz Perrone. Stranahan began to worry. Joey's brother had shed the drover's coat for a three-piece blue pinstripe. He made a game effort to tame his beard and wild mane, but he still looked like an outlaw biker who'd been dressed by his attorney for a bail hearing.